Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In September 2008, AIG, the world's largest insurance company, collapsed, and the U.S. investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. It was the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Its assets far surpassed other bankruptcies, such as WorldCom and Enron. Lehman Brothers was the fourth largest U.S. investment bank at the time of its collapse, with 25,000 employees worldwide. Lehman Brothers was one of the giant banks whose subprime loans were blamed for triggering the global economic meltdown, with bank after bank declaring huge losses. As the federal government and the Federal Reserve committed tens of billions of dollars to bailing out Wall Street, millions of Americans lost their homes, their retirement, and their jobs. On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by speaking with economists who saw the crisis coming 5 years ago. What have we really learned since 2008, and what has changed? Today, we're joined by James Galbraith. He's an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His new book is Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis. Hi, James. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Dean Baker, an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean also runs the Center's Beat the Press blog, in which he closely examines and scrutinizes media coverage of the economy. Hi, Dean. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So, Dean, some new information just came out about record profits. Banks just marked another record profit period in the second quarter, clearing $42 billion in 3 months from April to June. So you've got that happening at a time when we're marking the five-year anniversary of the crisis. What's going through your mind 5 years later?
Well, I mean, kind of what's been going on for most of the last 5 years. Basically, you know, we rescued the banking system. We kept it. If anything, banks are more concentrated today because we had huge mergers that in more normal times you would have at least scrutinized, probably would have required some divestment. So here I'm thinking of Bear Stearns being taken over by J.P. Morgan, Wachovia being taken over by Wells Fargo. So we have an even more concentrated banking system than we ever did. And it's pretty much business as usual. I mean, Dodd-Frank did do some positive things, but as a practical matter, I don't think anyone could say with a straight face we've ended too big to fail. And also, we haven't ended the abusive banking practices. We see them going on constantly. The London Whale trades, you know, one example, their failure, the continued failure of banks to be able to comply with the laws on dealing with mortgages and foreclosures. It's very hard to see how anything's changed. And again, what was just striking here is if we had just let the market do its work, if we left this to the, you know, the magic of the market, we would have had a whole different banking system. So the government actually actively intervened to restore the status quo ante. And, you know, if anything, as I say, it might well be worse than ever.
Wow. When you talk about the concentration of the banks, back then there were five investment banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and two financial conglomerates, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. Are these still the major players or have we seen any changes there?
Well, J.P. Morgan's even bigger because it now has Bear Stearns. Bank of America has Merrill Lynch. Citigroup has been downsized a little bit, but still a conglomerate and still a very big player. So you're really hard-pressed to say, if anything, it would be more concentrated today than it was before the crisis.
James, do you agree that it's business as usual and not much has changed since 2008? James?
The economic climate is really dramatically different than it was before the crisis. And the banking sector in the period before the crisis was in a ferment of activity generating and marketing to the world many hundreds of billions of dollars of essentially corrupt mortgages. This activity has ceased. There's the construction industry has been moribund. The housing prices have fallen dramatically. And fundamentally, we've been in a world in which mortgages get issued if they meet the terms for being purchased by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So it is true the banks are highly profitable. They're highly profitable on the basis of much less, for better or worse, much less economic activity than was true before the crisis. And so I think we're in a world in which one can ask, what exactly are these institutions doing that requires them to be on the scale and to enjoy the power that they do enjoy?
Well, and so what explains these profits? Because I wanted to get sort of an economic crisis 101, and so I rewatched half of Inside Job this morning. And just to, you know, get a kind of refresher on derivatives and credit default swaps and all of that stuff that most people can't even really explain. And in the film, Martin Wolf, a chief economics commentator for the Financial Times, says that these profits really are not real income. They're just money being created by the system as and booked as income 2 or 3 years down the road. And it's basically a global Ponzi scheme. That's what he said in, a couple years ago. Does that still apply today, James, when you look at these massive profits?
What was going on at the time in the run-up to the crisis was the banks were booking revenue from originating mortgages and from bundling them into securities and selling them to investors downstream. That money was certainly real money from the standpoint of the executives who took enormous payouts as a result and from the standpoint of the profit statements of the banks. The problem was it was corrupt money. It was money that was based upon losses that were going to be absorbed somewhere. Many of them were absorbed by investors around the world. Many of them ultimately were absorbed by the banks themselves. And then you have the executives who are responsible who basically walked away with their pockets extremely well lined. Now that, I think, is very different from the post-crisis environment. The banks are still making money. For a long time, what they were doing basically was taking very, very cheap funds from the central bank, say cost of funds basically zero, and lending it back to the government at 2-3%, and pocketing the difference, an activity which does not require any great banking skill. They have also been making money, and I think more recently, from other sources. They certainly were investing for a while in emerging markets, for example, and they're doing the usual kinds of carry trades that banks can turn into very profitable operations. So all of that is, I think, going on. But what we're not seeing is the return to the what one might expect to be the ordinary function of the banking system, which is to support business activity and to support job creating, support job creation in the United States. That's, of course, a major problem, because with the federal government retrenching and the banking system essentially in this dysfunctional mode, we have an overall economy which has been at best growing very slowly and certainly hasn't replaced many millions of the jobs that existed before the crisis.
Right, and so many of the jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs. And Dean, is there a potential for another crisis? Because, as you say, not much has really changed in terms of regulation.
Well, I don't really see one anytime soon. I just would give a little different story than Jamie there. I'm actually not at all, I don't really blame the banks for the current weakness of the economy. I mean, I think this was like 100% predictable, because the basic story was the economy was being driven by the housing bubble. And this was just like clear as day. We had a huge building boom. And actually, there's not really any surprises to me in terms of construction. We continue to have enormous excess supply. So, you know, if the banks offered free money, I don't know if builders would build any more houses than they have. You continue to see vacancy rates at extraordinarily high levels, or down from their peaks in 2010, but they're still extraordinarily high. So I don't think you need a story about lack of access to credit.
No, that's not my argument, but go ahead.
Okay, whatever. I'm just saying. So I don't really see the banks as being central in the weakness of the economy. We had, prior to the downturn, the economy was being driven by massive consumption because people had equity. That equity's disappeared. House prices are back pretty much to their trend level. So they're not low. They're not high. They're pretty much at their trend level. And construction's pretty much what you'd expect to be, but we don't have the boom. And the story is we don't have anything to replace that. So it's a very, very simple story. There's no, you know, there's no magic. We don't have any magic elixir that's suddenly going to cause investment to spark. Investment's pretty much at normal levels of GDP. It's not high, it's not low, it's just normal. And consumption is actually fairly high relative to disposable income. So if anything, you know, all these people running around saying people are depressed, they're not consuming. Well, they might be depressed, but they're actually consuming at a fairly high rate. But the long and short, do I expect another crisis? Well, no, the real story of the crisis to me was that the bubble burst, and that was what gave us this downturn. And we don't have another bubble right now. So can you have a story where a bank finds itself in trouble? You know, J.P. Morgan had their London whale, which they lost a lot of money. It wasn't that much money to them, but if you had another bank that, you know, lost $6 billion, that would be a much, much bigger hit. So I could imagine we could see major banks that take big hits. It's very hard for me to envision, at least anytime soon, the same sort of crisis we saw in 2008.
Do you agree with that, James?
Yeah, I do, and I don't disagree with Dean's characterization of the underlying condition of the economy. The issue here is that nothing has replaced the boom or the bubble that existed prior to September 2008. Could there be another banking crisis? The place I would keep my eye on is Europe at this point. There is a distinct possibility of something cracking in the European periphery, whether that's Greece or possibly in Spain or Italy, in which case the kind of blowback that we might experience here is, I think, a little bit unpredictable. But in any event, we are still experiencing very much the aftermath of the ongoing nature of the global financial crisis, and the Europeans are still experiencing it quite acutely, and I don't think they've gotten past the financial dangers that they face either.
And James, what do you think of the media reports that we often get about this economic recovery?
Well, there is a tendency for commentators to pick up certain styles of language. They talked about the great moderation as though that were a permanent transformation of the economy in the period before the crisis. And then they immediately shifted over to talk about the great recession, which implies that there will be a recovery following, and then they expect a recovery to occur. I think it's a much more, there's a strong argument to be made that we have really turned a corner and are in what will be for a long time, and perhaps indefinitely, a much slower growth environment than we've seen previously.
Dean, you follow media coverage very closely for your Beat the Press blog. What do you make of this economic recovery that we hear about on a regular basis?
Well, I think it's a very dismal recovery. You know, I think Jamie's right. We're looking at a period of very slow growth, and it's sort of striking that, you know, basically the media have worked sort of to lower people's expectations. So they were talking about growth for the second quarter coming in at a strong 2.5%. Well, our trend rate of growth, meaning, you know, if we were somewhere near full employment, how fast would the economy be growing? Well, Congressional Budget Office puts that somewhere in the range of 2.2 to 2.5%. So if we're at 2.5%, that means we're just growing roughly at our trend rate, give or take a little bit. And that means we're making up zero of the lost ground. And, you know, again, these are all Congressional Budget Office numbers. They put us down somewhere close to $1 trillion below our trend level of output, meaning that's the slack in the economy. So if we're not making up any ground on that, it's pretty hard to talk about that as a good story. So, you know, there's been a real lowering of expectations, and I have to show when I talk to reporters, you know, I send them the links because they don't believe me. I go, you know, look, when we're coming out of prior downturns, 74, 75, or 81, 82, when we had severe downturns, we had quarters the economy is growing 7 or 8%. So the idea at 2.5%, we should all go out and celebrate, it's close to crazy in my view. But as I say, we've had this lowering of expectations and the idea that, you know, people should just get used to this. And, you know, unfortunately, I think if people don't see there's any alternatives, which I think in many cases people don't believe there are any alternatives, then, you know, you take what you get. But it's very, I think, from stepping back and going, you know, where were we 5 years ago? The idea we'd be sitting here down 9 million jobs from trend level. We'd have 7.5% unemployment or 7.4% unemployment, millions of people just having left the labor market altogether, and we would consider that satisfactory. I mean, you know, people would think we're crazy pessimists if we were saying that that was the world we're in. But, you know, somehow we're supposed to be happy about that.
That is Dean Baker. He's an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He also runs the Center's Beat the Press blog. He closely watches and scrutinizes media coverage of the economy. James Galbraith is an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His new book is Inequality and Instability, a Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. And on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the financial crisis 5 years later. In September 2008, AIG, the world's largest insurance company, collapsed, and the U.S. investment bank Lehman Brothers filed bankruptcy. And we saw tens of millions of people lost their jobs, their homes, their retirement. And so what have we learned? I mean, what do you now know today that you didn't know in 2008? And what questions do you have about what we've learned and where we are today and what has changed or not changed? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before we get to calls, I mean, when you both look back at 2008, what do you know now that you didn't know 5 years ago, James?
Well, Dean and I spent one of the most interesting afternoons, I think, of our professional lives together.
Fair enough.
The day before the vote on the original bailout bill, the TARP bill, we were invited to the Capitol by members of Congress who were what they called the Skeptics Caucus. They're not certain exactly how they should proceed in this moment of high drama and with a bill that was at best extremely vaguely worded, even after it had been considerably worked over by the House Banking Committee. So the question was what to do, and Dean and I had a difference of view of this. As Dean will recall, his position was that as he said earlier in the show, that they should refuse to act and allow the banking system to crumble, and then pick up the pieces as best one could at that moment. That would lead to a better outcome. My position was I didn't have the courage to go along with that. Frankly, my view was that we were in September of 2008, it might have had a serious effect on the election outcome, but that in January of 2009, with a new administration, be in a much better position to take commanding position and force major changes in the banking system. I wasn't prepared to risk 3 months of chaos while the Bush administration was still in power and crumbling. Well, we got to January of 2009, and we got the bailout. We got to January of 2009, and what happened was that the commanding position of the press for really major change never materialized. In fact, the personnel from the Bush administration were largely held over, Secretary Geithner, Chairman Bernanke, and the strategy of the Bush administration was largely continued, which was, to preserve the banking institutions as they were and hope that they would then figure out some way to regenerate the economy. It was a strategy which, in many ways, was just a very serious mistake all the way through. And so what I've learned is that when the next time we're in this position, I'm going to be much more inclined to follow Dean's advice.
What about you, Dean? What do you know now that you didn't know 5 years ago?
Well, Jamie's absolutely right, by the way. That was fascinating, and I learned a lot having been there and talking with members of Congress. And, these were many of the most progressive members of Congress were there, and it was striking how, they were genuinely scared, as would anyone in their right mind. I mean, this was, a situation we hadn't seen since, none of us were alive, in 29, the financial crisis at the start of the Great Depression. But what was really striking to me was how much the media sort of fell in line and basically played the home team, that the banks were the home team. So, as Jamie noted, the original bill went down. So it was quite striking. There was this talk, suddenly everyone said, okay, well, we've got to double down. Everyone was talking in the media, New York Times. I think New York Times might have done it as well, but NPR was doing pieces on the Great Depression. So, if we don't do this, we're going to have the Great Depression. And I challenged a number of people, like, what do you mean? Because my memory of the Great Depression, not my memory, my understanding was this was on the one hand, you know, a financial crisis that was very poorly dealt with, that was the initial downturn. But the reason we had a decade of double-digit unemployment was an inadequate response. We eventually got out of the Great Depression by spending a ton of money on World War II. But, you know, if we had spent a ton of money in 1931 rather than 1941, we wouldn't have had 10 years of double-digit unemployment. So my understanding was there was nothing about the original crisis. Of course, it could have been better dealt with. But there was nothing about the original crisis that necessitated the Great Depression. The problem was we didn't have an adequate response until finally under the pressure of the war. We had an adequate response in terms of spending what was needed to get the economy out of the Depression. But nonetheless, that was the refrain, and of course it continues to be the refrain. Endlessly we get told, well, we should be thankful we didn't have another Great Depression. So that part's been striking. The other part, and this is something, you know, it just, you know, I have to go back and check this to make sure I'm not just making this thing up and saying bad things about Ben Bernanke, who, you know, I just know very casually. He seems like a very decent guy. But the story here, the best line they had, why do you have to do the TARP? Why did you have to do this? The best line they had, this is from Ben Bernanke, was that the commercial paper market was shutting down. Because if you tell me Lehman's going under, all right, well, that's the way it goes. Big investment bank, they're supposed to know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. That's too bad. You know, you can go down the list. But commercial paper market's extremely important because most major companies finance their ongoing operations, meaning their payroll, paying the electric bill, paying all the bills they're paying every month. They finance that by selling commercial paper. If that market shuts down, then you're really in a situation where the economy is going to shut down. So, no, you know, workers at Verizon, an otherwise healthy company, you know, they're not getting their paycheck. They can't send the electric bill in, you know, so suddenly everything just shut down. So that, you know, if you could really establish that that was true. Now, people dispute that. I'm not going to go into details on that. But what was fascinating about it was, and I didn't realize this at the time, I can confess for not knowing the full powers of the Fed, Ben Bernanke by himself had the power to support the commercial paper market. The weekend after the TARP was approved, he announced a special lending facility to buy commercial paper. So this was never an issue. They didn't need the TARP. Ben Bernanke could do that himself. But he went out there and told everyone, we have to pass the TARP because otherwise the commercial paper market's shutting down and it's going to bring the economy with it. So it was the level of, I guess, lack of honesty here that, you know, again, I've been in Washington a long time. I grew up in Chicago under what we call the real Mayor Daley, so I didn't have illusions about honesty in politics, but it really carried it another notch that I hadn't expected.
Well, let's take one call before we go to break. Let's hear from Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is your just an interesting comment about the that there currently isn't a bubble being formed or having been formed, and with quantitative easing, it's really cheap for banks to borrow money, well, basically free, and they have invested that in bonds and equities, and you've seen a huge run-up in the equity market despite the fact that the economy's fundamentals are really quite poor, especially when you look at the job market, yet the stock market is at record high. Bonds, until just about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, were just doing gangbusters. And you have to look at that and say, well, all that money that the banks to use through quantitative easing was put use. And you also look at credit default swaps and all the other nasty derivatives. If you look at the quantity of derivatives and the value of them.
Hey, Drew, your line isn't so great. Can you get to your question?
What's that?
Can you get to your question? I'm sorry, your line isn't so great.
My question is, do you really honestly think that we aren't in a bubble situation again?
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. Your line is just not so great. I'll get to your question right after the break. Today, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the economic crisis of 2008. And what have we learned since then? What has really changed? The banks have cleared $42 billion in profits from April to June. They are set to pay out $23 billion in bonuses. And we'd love to take your calls and your questions right after the break.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Gino Piper Ferreira. He is a rapper, performer, and deputy with the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. He's out with a one-man play called Cops and Robbers, and it shows the conflicts and misunderstandings between cops and citizens. So what does good policing look like? What do you actually want from police? That is tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Mark Pendergrast about his new book, For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. And he asks the question, how did an innocuous soft drink, more than 99% sweetened water, come to dominate the consumer product of the American century and beyond? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the financial crisis. It's been 5 years since AIG, the world's largest insurance company, collapsed, and the U.S. investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. This was the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. It triggered the largest single stock point drop in history, and the global recession cost the world tens of trillions of dollars, costing the people their savings, their jobs, and their homes. So what do you know now that you didn't know 5 years ago? What has changed? What have you learned? What questions do you have about what we are currently facing? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. And if you have a story about how the crisis affected you, we'd love to hear from you. We're joined today by James Galbraith, an economist and professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas. His new book is Inequality and Instability. Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He also runs the Center's Beat the Press blog, in which he scrutinizes and closely watches media coverage of these issues. So, Dean, what are your thoughts on Drew's question? He thinks that we're definitely in a bubble.
Well, if you look at stock prices, I mean, stocks are not supposed to reflect the economy, and they don't. They reflect corporate profits, and corporate profits are at record highs, and stock prices have gone up along with them. Now, if you just drew a straight line and you said, okay, go back to where we were in 2007 and assume stock prices had risen in step with the trend growth of the economy, we're actually somewhat below that. So I'm not worried about stocks being particularly out of line, not that I have an exact number or anyone tells me what the proper price would be, but there's nothing, you know, in 2000, it was easy to see stocks were out of line, we had a bubble. Today, it's really not, there's nothing about stock prices that look particularly out of line to me. In terms of bonds, bond prices are high because interest rates are extraordinarily low. That's conscious policy. I mean, that is the point of quantitative easing, try to bring down long-term interest rates, and they've done that. Now, of course, long-term interest rates have taken a big jump in the last couple of months as people have become fearful that the Fed would pull back from its quantitative easing policy later in the year. So, you know, are bond prices likely to fall further? My bet is they probably do. Would I call that a bubble? Well, you know, you sort of hope that people have a lot of money in long-term bonds, understand that there's a risk of them falling, and you know, that they've sheltered themselves from that. Have they all done it? I'm sure not. But I don't see any great consequence. Let's say the long-term rates on Treasury bonds were to go up another percentage point or 1.5 percentage points over the next 2 or 3 years. I think very possible. I don't see any dire consequences from that.
And do you have anything to add there, James?
Yeah, I think the distinction I would draw here is that we've been discussing whether there is a bubble in financial asset prices. Dean says, and I think he's right, that there's no great evidence of one. But what clearly isn't happening is what you might call a credit boom. And the last two waves of economic growth in the 1990s and then in the 2000s were driven overwhelmingly by the extension of credit. In the 1990s, basically to business for investment in information technology, and the 2000s, as we've discussed, in basically real estate loans and home equity loans, things of that nature. Those things were behind a substantial amount of what passes for economic growth and employment. And there's nothing like that going on. And that's, I think, a big difference. When I said earlier that the banking sector isn't doing what we expect banks to do, this is what I referred to, whether that's because of demand-side pressures that people don't want to borrow or questions of the institutions not being willing to lend. I mean, the two are basically two sides of the same coin. But the basic fact is that our slow growth condition is because we have been relying very heavily on the private financial sector to carry out this function, and it's not happening, and I believe it probably won't happen. I am much more of a long-term growth pessimist than Dean is. I think that we would find it very difficult now to replicate the growth performance that we saw in recoveries in the 70s and the 80s under current conditions for a number of reasons. But that's a different kind of disagreement that I think we have.
And just quickly, before we go back to calls, are small businesses still having a really hard time getting loans, James? Or Dean?
I don't know whether they are having trouble having access to loans. I don't believe there's any great recovery of overall lending in the business sector. If there were, there'd be a lot more job creation than there is.
Well, we've got full line, so let's go next to Ruth Ann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Yeah, hi there. I was wondering if the guests could address the impact and the kind of, the Dodd-Frank Act, because there was an article, I'm not being a very good caller, I'm forgetting the author who wrote Dodd-Frank Defangled and was just talking about how both chambers of Congress worked ad nauseum to weaken Dodd-Frank, so even if it had some teeth in it in the beginning, there are no teeth left.
Yes, Gary Rivlin wrote that for The Nation, and that
thank
was
you.
Yeah,
you're better than I remembered the piece.
Well,
there's been a few of those.
Yeah, I mean, it was such an extensive piece with really good graphics, including the fact that bank lobbyists outnumbered politicians by 20-1. Dean, did you read that piece?
And I didn't read that piece, but I read a number of others. I actually thought she was referring to Matt Taibbi's piece in Rolling Stone from a couple months back, making a very similar argument.
So what are your thoughts on Dodd-Frank? I mean, where is it today?
I'd say that assessment's very much right, that you know almost everything in there has been watered down, so it has very little impact. I mean, just to take a couple issues where I'd done a little work, I remember in the immediate wake of the housing bust, the financial crisis, everyone was running around the hill saying, you know, we're going to make sure that when you securitize mortgages, you have skin in the game, meaning that, you know, if you're a Goldman Sachs, you're securitizing mortgage, you're going to have a stake in that mortgage. So if you put on a junk mortgage, you're going to pay a price for it. So you had people saying they're going to hold 20%. So I was just sitting there. I wasn't one of the loudest ones yelling. I don't represent anyone. I'm just sitting there at the meetings. I go, oh, that's a lot, but whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, so then I heard it gets watered down to 10%, then 5%. And then they say, well, we're going to let some mortgages pass through with, you know, they don't have to hold anything. So the criteria there was it has to be, you know, kind of a rock solid mortgage, you know, prime mortgage. You put down 20%, you have good credit rating, then you don't have to hold anything. So you go, okay, well, those tend to be pretty good, so maybe that's fine. Well, that got watered down, so you have to put down 5% and not necessarily have that good a credit rating. So that was all the industry's doing. They just walked right through, totally eviscerated that regulation. Another one that was, I think, even more egregious just because it was so damn simple was this was something put through by an amendment put through by Al Frank, and I worked with him a little bit on this, a little personal stake in it. One of the problems in the leading up to the crisis was the credit rating agencies are paid by the issuer. Goldman Sachs wants to put out a new mortgage-backed security. They call up Moody's, they call up Standard & Poor's and say, hey, come down and rate it. We're paying you. Mm-hmm. Well, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, they understand. If they want to get the business again, they're going to give it a good rating. So they were giving everything AAA ratings, and their own people were saying, this stuff's garbage. You know, but the higher-ups are saying, well, just give it an investment-grade rating and, you know, shut up. Well, Franken proposed that you would take the hiring decision away from the issuer. So when Citigroup or Morgan Stanley has a new mortgage-backed security, rather than calling up Moody's or Standard & Poor's themselves, they call up the Securities and Exchange Commission. And Securities Exchange Commission then makes the hiring decision. So that means Moody's and Standard & Poor's have no reason to lie because they're going to get the same amount of business whether they, you know, whether they say it's investment grade or not. In fact, they'll look bad by having bad ratings if they do lie. Well, that seemed very simple. Franken put it up for as an amendment, got 65 votes, partisan support, passed overwhelmingly. What happened was Barney Frank gutted that in the conference. He said, oh, we're going to study it. We'll have the Securities and Exchange Commission study it. Securities and Exchange Commission got dozens of comments from the industry, almost nothing on the other side, because we don't have anyone who's paid full-time to do this. They have dozens of people who are paid full-time to do that. Securities and Exchange Commission said, this is too complicated for us. We wouldn't be able to figure out how to, and I'm caricaturing it only a little bit. They said, this is too complicated for us. We wouldn't know how to pick a credit rating agency. We can't do this. We have to keep the current system.
Hmm. Well, and if we're losing any of you, I highly recommend watching the documentary Inside Job, because they clearly talk about CDOs and derivatives, and they have great graphics. It's very easy to understand. You can actually watch it online for free. Just search Watch Inside Job. James, what would you add to that about Dodd-Frank? Does it have any teeth at all?
I have really very little to add to what Dean said. I think the trajectory has been clear. The rulemaking has been very slow with Dodd-Frank, and every report that comes out suggests that it's heavily influenced by industry, for sure.
So is this practice still happening? Are lenders selling loans to investment banks and the banks combining thousands of these loans to create these derivatives? Is all of this still happening?
No, these markets have been dead. I mean, it's Dodd-Frank was, and these regulations were intended to prevent this from happening again, but you'd have to ask who would be in the business of buying such a loan. You've got to have, basically what was going on here was they were selling securities that were destined to default at some point. They were destined to go bad, and you have to ask, why would an independent investor, having gone through that experience once, come back into this game? My sense is that, you know, there may be some of this activity going on, but the scale, if the scale were anything like what it was before the crisis, then, of course, the economic statistics would be apparently more favorable than they are. That was how you had substantially the economic growth that you did have in 2005 to 2006, 2007.
I think that is largely right, but I will say that I am concerned about this here and there. The Times had an article about 3 months back about in the commercial real estate market, where you do have, you still have some commercial mortgage-backed securities, that there's evidence that Standard & Poor's deliberately lowered their rating standards in order to get more business. Now, has it gotten to where we were back in 2005, 2006? Probably not. And certainly it's not on the same scale. So it's nothing like, you know, what we saw in terms of, you know, having the same impact on the economy. But I think you may have some pockets where you do see the same sorts of abuses.
By the way, the way one should deal with this is by having aggressive regulators who are overseeing the behavior of the banking system and who can issue cease and desist orders when they see something wrong. This has, in fact, happened before. There was subprime mortgage boom that was incipient in commercial real estate in the Southwest in the early 90s, and the regulators blocked it. But when the cops are taken off the beat, which is a big part of the problem in the 2000s, you know, that you can have the rules and regulations, and if the supervisors are not there to enforce them, you're going to see all kinds of problems emerging sooner or later.
What does that look like right now? Because in 2008, 145 people were cut from the enforcement division of the SEC, and someone testified on Capitol Hill saying it was reduced to a staff of one. What does that look like today?
Well, I think we have a major problem with the failure to enforce the criminal as well as civil statutes and regulations in this area. The fact is that there were massive frauds associated with the entire real estate debacle, and we should have spent a great deal of the last 5 years cleaning them up, as we did in the savings and loan crisis when 1,000 industry insiders were prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned by federal enforcement agencies. So far, nothing like that has happened with the largest perpetrators of the financial frauds that led up to the crisis. And I think one of the consequences of that is that there really isn't going to be any easy recovery of confidence in the financial system. Let's just take one particularly egregious case, leaving aside the mortgage situation. Look at this, at the situation where HSBC was found to have facilitated vast amounts of money laundering for Mexican drug cartels. And yet the Department of Justice said, oh, well, you're not going to prosecute anybody because that might cost jobs in the United States. It's a preposterous position, and one which clearly tells you, if you're looking at this from the outside and asking, am I dealing with reputable people and safe institutions that are being supervised effectively and being made to comply with laws? The answer to that is no. So I come back to the argument that the financial system needs to be made to conform to standards of law and regulation. And if that's not the case, the whole economy is going to be the loser.
Let me just pick up on Jamie's point and take that one step further, that this isn't, because this sometimes may sound like we're being vindictive and we want these people to punish, which frankly I do. I mean, you break the law and a lot of people suffer. You should be punished. But that aside, what's really important here, more important, is the issue of incentives, because you want those people at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to understand if you knowingly break the law, if you're committing fraud, you might go to jail for it. You might not see your family for 3 years. We want them to know that, so that way they won't do it. And what they learned from their lesson from the financial crisis is, no, you know, you might get you might have to testify before Congress. You might get some embarrassing articles in the paper. That's going to be the end of the story.
But let me go a little bit further. Let's just suppose, for purposes of argument, that the government announced that it was shutting down air traffic control. Okay? What would happen? Do you think people would still get on airplanes? Of course they wouldn't. The airplanes are the best airplanes in the world, the best airplanes ever made, but if they hit each other at high speeds in midair, the consequences are very bad. The industry would collapse at once. And the same thing is true when you create an environment where the people who are not themselves members of the financial sector, but who are investors who have money at risk, understand that they are dealing with an unsupervised and out of control element of the financial sector. They suddenly become very, very cautious. They want to put their money in safe instruments and keep it in U.S. Treasuries, for example, and they become extremely unwilling to take the kinds of ordinary business risks and financial risks that you would hope people would take, because they just become wary. And this is a problem which you experience in many, many countries. It takes a very well-run country to create an environment in which you can have this kind of ongoing business activity, because people feel that they're dealing in a reasonably honest environment.
That is James Galbraith, an economist and professor at the University of Texas, author of Inequality and Instability. Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. On today's Your Call, we're talking about the financial crisis 5 years later. Thank you for calling, Ruth Ann. And we have just about 10 minutes left, so why don't we take a few calls, and then we'll get responses from James and Dean. And thank you all for waiting patiently, but this is a huge topic. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program. I have a couple of questions. First of all, Federal Reserve, the Treasury, injected a lot of money into the system to bail out the financial system. With hindsight, was that equitable, and how much was refunded to the federal government? That's my first question. The second question is this: regarding the issue of growth and restore the high growth rate that we had perhaps 30, 40 years ago. What about investing massively in the infrastructure? Everywhere we read, we are reading that the system in this country is falling apart. What about doing what the Chinese and now the Japanese are doing? I'll stop here. Thank you for a good program.
Okay, thank you, Max. We'll get to your question in a minute. Let's hear from Pat in Santa Cruz. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thank you. As I listen to this program, I am becoming more and more distressed to the point of almost feeling ill.
Uh-oh.
My question would be, is there any requirement for payback by these institutions? And I'd like to hear a discussion of that. We, as a country, are going to need this money, to be sarcastic, for our next war. Thank you.
Payback of the bailout. Thank you, Pat. We don't want you to feel ill. Sorry about that, but we'll get your question answered in a minute. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi. Thanks a lot for this for holding this together. And we were wondering, and I second your recommendation of the film, The Inside Job. In retrospect, you know, we try to learn from these economic crises. And in the case of the one that we're discussing this morning, this is rather unusual because it comes at the junction of two administrations, and there was no chance that the Bush administration could continue because it was termed out, and there was every opportunity for the Obama campaign to prevail. But at some point, you know, if you were the captain of the Concordia and suddenly you handed off the ship's the helm to the lieutenant or to the officer of the day, and you said, "Congratulations, you're now the captain," and you left the ship moments after it ran aground. Well, perhaps that's an analogy to the situation that was happening in 2008 during the conclusion of the political campaign. And we were wondering if anyone has taken a microscope to that time frame and examined it to see in sequence what happened during that explosion. And
you mean just in 2008?
Yeah, has anybody looked at it? Because, you know, some of it is engineered and some of it isn't. Some of it is opportunistic and some of it is just greed.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that's so great about Inside Job is, I mean, it goes back further than George W. to Ronald Reagan. And that's when so much of the financial deregulation started. And then we just got a question about Glass-Steagall, which was during Clinton, Congress overturned Glass-Steagall and we had massive deregulation. So do you want to take that question first, Dean, and then we'll go to the other questions?
Well, we certainly had a sequence of deregulation that sort of laid the path for this. Glass-Steagall was part of the story. I don't know if the biggest part. I mean, in some ways, the Commodities Modernization Act passed in 2000 that took away the ability to regulate derivatives might have been the biggest part, because what that meant was essentially the government didn't have the ability to regulate credit default swaps, which were, you know, the proximate cause of the financial collapse in 2008 with AIG. So this was a long process, and you know that was going on over several decades. And you know, the complicity of both parties, certainly, you know, our profession, the economics profession, was really front and center. There's a famous incident back in 2005. I call this Greenspan Fest 05, where the Fed has its annual meeting in Jackson Hole. And they were just celebrating the great moderation. You know, we have all these things answered. And University of Chicago economist raised issues saying, you know, look, we have all these bases for instability. And he was just, you know, hectored by Larry Summers, who called him a financial Luddite who didn't understand modern finance. You know, so we had a whole series of deregulatory moves that sort of opened up the path for the crisis we saw. So it certainly wasn't just something that, you know, George W. Bush, he deserves plenty of blame, but it wasn't anything that he alone had done. This had been going on for decades.
Right. And on Glass-Steagall, since we have an email about it, what are your thoughts on Elizabeth Warren and John McCain wanting to reinstate Glass-Steagall?
I would love to see it. I mean, I'm not going to say that would be a panacea, but, you know, anything you could do to you know, have more control of the financial system. You know, the basic start with Glass-Steagall is separating banks that have government-insured deposits. The quid pro quo of government-insured deposits is supposed to be that you can't do a lot with them. You have to be very safe. You're getting an insurance pack from the government. You don't have market discipline. So the government's going to say you can only do very few things with that. On the other hand, you could have investment banks that go off and speculate. They don't have insured deposits. So Glass-Steagall's about reestablishing that separation. The Volcker Rule was supposed to do something like that. I'd at least be in the camp saying the Volcker Rule is probably a waste of paper at this point.
And Max wanted to know how much of the bailout has been refunded. And at the end of the day, how much was the entire bailout, James?
Oh, I don't know that I have a figure at the tip of my tongue. It was vast if you add up the facilities that the Federal Reserve put together to provide liquidity to the economy. And basically what happened was that the government assumed the task of providing access to cash to practically the entire private sector. And so these numbers get to be very large very quickly. Could it have been avoided? I think the answer to that is no. that at the end of the day, when the private financial sector is no longer performing that job, has to be performed. And so the Federal Reserve stepped in and did it, including hundreds of billions of dollars in currency swap agreements to provide dollar liquidity to the rest of the world.
And Pat wanted to know, were there any requirements for the paybacks?
Well, yeah, the TARP funds and so forth that were lent to the banks have been all paid back quite early, because the banks wanted to end up out of their not to have any particular restrictions on their behavior and on their compensation schemes. But have we exacted out of this a fundamental reform in the structure or the behavior of the banking system? And the answer to that is no, we haven't. In fact, we've basically given that sector a clear signal that it is in control of the policy process. For the reasons I gave earlier, is very unfortunate. My own view is that the financial sector is vastly larger than it has any purpose in being, and we could have not a great economy, but a substantially more smoothly functioning economy if we cut down on that sector.
And let me ask you both, we just have a minute left. William Butler, chief economist for Citigroup in Inside Jobs, said the banks like monopoly power because they know that when they're too big, they'll be bailed out. So, Dean, I mean, what would it take to change this? I mean, right now we're seeing that President Obama's overwhelming favorite for Federal Reserve Chairman is Larry Summers, according to reports.
Well, you could break up the large banks. I mean, I'm a huge fan of a financial transactions tax, which would certainly cut down on a lot of the excesses here. But you really should be looking to break up the large banks. Just to quickly throw in a point about the TARP being paid back, I think.
And we only have 20 seconds.
Yeah, we gave them below market loans. They did pay them back, but it's as though I got a 1% mortgage and I paid it back. That's essentially what we said here.
And James, 5 seconds, what would you change?
I would downsize the banking sector. You'd have fewer banks and smaller banks.
James Galbraith is an economist and professor at the University of Texas and author of Inequality and Instability. Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What is good policing? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Eugenio Piper Ferreira, a rapper, performer, and deputy with the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. His one-man play, Cops and Robbers, shows the conflicts and misunderstandings between police officers and citizens. And it raises the question, what does good policing look like? Do officers need to be from the community they're patrolling? And what do people actually want from the police? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up next here on KALW, it's World Have Your Say. Are you anxious to try out that new span of the eastern portion of the Bay Bridge? Well, that's going to get old after a while, so maybe it's time to rethink your daily commute. Here's some fuel for thought. By switching to public transportation or even a car share, you're making the Bay Area cleaner and greener. And if you switch to a bike commute, you get a healthier you as well. Here's where we come in. Donate your vehicle to KALW. We'll take care of all the paperwork. Just takes a couple of minutes, and you'll end up with a nice tax deduction. Learn more at our website, kalw.org, or call our representatives at 888-KALW-CAR. That's 888-525-9227. And thank you for making everything we do here at KALW possible. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Ben James. Welcome to the programme where you help us report and discuss the news. This is the BBC's World Have Your Say.
There is a very slippery slope when you end up taking justice on your own hands and without a proper judiciary process in which there is a chance to listen to both sides.
A story from Mexico has got you talking about vigilante justice. Posts on social media claim the murderer of two bus drivers in Ciudad Juarez is a woman calling herself Diana the Hunter. The messages say the attacks are in revenge for nighttime sexual violence on the same buses. There's no way of proving this explanation for the killings, but it certainly started a discussion about whether being a vigilante is ever an appropriate response to crime. Are there any circumstances in which you can take the law into your own hands?